This is The Conversation. It's episode 119 with Steve Shane, collector, art lover, aficionado of seduction meets repulsion. I'm Michael Shaw. The website for this podcast is theconversationpod.com. If you are new here, this is a podcast featuring conversations with artists, gallerists, art writers, and collectors. Finally, it has been a long time since I've had a collector on the show. I'm grateful to have gotten Steve, and we had quite a extended conversation. It was actually in two parts, as you will hear. And I'm excited to be putting this out as Miami Basel 2015, or I should say the Miami Art Fairs of 2015, are swinging through the weekend section. My fantasy, as embarrassing as it may sound, is that everybody heading back to their respective destinations, whether it's New York, LA, Paris, London, etc., and Singapore from Miami, are on the plane listening to this podcast. So won't you help me make that fantasy a reality? Another fantasy I have, I will share with you on the back end. Let me just say before we get into it that I spoke with Steve initially the day after Thanksgiving 2015. He was in Detroit where he grew up. So if he says here, he's talking about Detroit. And we then, as I will mention in a brief segue announcement, we spoke again when he was at Miami. I had some questions that I felt like were not asked, and so I got into those in session two. But they are seamlessly woven together, as you will hear. Thank you, by the way, to Irina Jurek for connecting me with Steve. Very much appreciated. Go listen to her episode. It's just a couple episodes old. All right, thank you very much for being here. I will talk to you a little bit more midway in the back end. Talk to you later. Well, we don't have to make mention of where you are, but we can if you want.
Yeah, I don't mind.
Okay.
I'm proud to be from Detroit, especially Detroit's getting to be the coolest place on earth.
Right. How long ago did you leave Detroit?
I left when I was 18.
Mm-hmm. And did you go straight to New York?
I went to University of Michigan, where I studied art history.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you have a background in art. I wasn't clear on that.
It started when I was, my background in art started in high school. The most important time, most important thing that ever happened in my life was in 11th grade in a school called in Southfield, Michigan, a suburb of Detroit, where in 11th grade I was put in 12th grade English. And in 12th grade I was put in a class called Humanities. And I would say that's one of the most important things that ever happened to me, because that's the moment when I changed from an acultural person to a cultural person due to a single teacher named Nancy Updegraff.
Mm. Well, I want to go, let's shift gears here, because I wanted to go back to something that became apparent when you and I first spoke, which is that you are doing sort of a reverse commute, which is living in Manhattan and working in New Jersey. So what is it that you're, what is the work that you do in New Jersey?
I'm a physician.
What kind of physician?
Anesthesiologist.
And is it, how was it there that you have your work in New Jersey as opposed to New York?
It's just, you know, where I first found a job.
I see. And you kind of set up shop. And
But I'm really, you know, I'm really close. Even if I didn't have an apartment in New York, it's really close.
I see.
I mean, when there's no traffic, it's like half hour.
Do you drive there?
But my heart, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But my heart and soul and, you know, my life is in Manhattan.
Right.
You know, it's my favorite place on earth, maybe.
Okay. So when did you first start collecting?
It was when I was in college. There was a dealer here named Suzanne Hilberry, who just passed away months ago, who was my friend. And I bought an Alex Katz work from her in the mid, I think around 1977. When I was still a student.
Wow. But what was it that, was there anything leading up to that point that made you say, I need to start buying some work?
Well, I could tell you how it happened. What I really call it, I don't really like the word collector. I'm an art lover or an art historian, and this collection is a side effect of my passion. So I'll tell you how I started putting art on the walls. So at University of Michigan, I studied art history. And then I think sophomore year, I went to New York by myself. I guess I might have been 19. By myself, meaning without mom and dad.
Right.
And I went to the museums. I mean, I'll never forget that I went to the Guggenheim for the first time ever, and there was a Dubuffet retrospective, and he was one of my favorite artists. But I went to all the museums. I went to the Whitney, MoMA, Guggenheim, and I found myself after looking through, after seeing the art, I'd go down to the bookstore gift shop and buy a reproduction poster or a postcard of what I liked. And I ended up buying a whole new suitcase just to fill all this, just to carry all this home. And then, you know, when you're young, like in your 20s, you change apartments a lot. And I always had this portfolio filled with reproduction posters like Modigliani, Chagall, Picasso, Calder, Renoir. And every time I moved into an apartment, I plastered the walls with art, like salon style.
Right.
And it's a matter of wanting to live with art. And it's really just the same thing I do now. I just plaster the walls with art, like Paris salon style. I just like to live with it.
Sure. But why? What's wrong with the word collector?
Oh, go ahead.
What's wrong with the word collector? Why does that bother you?
Well, especially nowadays, any schmo could be a collector. Anyone with a wallet could be a collector. And I think it's getting to be an uglier and uglier term.
Mm-hmm.
Especially people who know nothing about art, who are just buying trophies.
Sure. Well, let's talk.
Turning it around.
Let's talk about that because
it's about like what. A Rolex watch, you know, it's like...
Well, that's been going on for a long time.
I think the audience has increased by like 20 since I started this. It used to be a much smaller audience, but maybe because of all these art fairs and maybe because of Miami Beach, which that's where I'm going to Sunday.
Yeah, there are two different strains. One is the strain of collector that buys a piece as a trophy, as you said, you know, to show it off, to brag about it, and so on. And that, I think, has going on certainly for a long time. I think what's new, though, and I wonder if you're getting a sense of this at all, too, is the speculative buying that people are buying a lot now online. You know, they're just buying from things they see online, and they're speculating based on how much they think that artist's value is going to go up.
Well, I think it all started with the skulls. Are you familiar with the skulls?
Which skulls?
Edith and I forget what guy's name.
Oh, right. The skull collectors. Yes.
Yeah, they owned a taxi company.
Right.
And they got a divorce, and then the collection had to be divided, and that's when this auction craze happened for contemporary art.
Mm-hmm.
But what I'm talking about is people buying, I mean, I don't want to talk about negative things, I'd rather talk about positive, but the people who buy with their ears or what's hot.
Sure.
I like to buy, when I do buy something, I buy something, I like, especially, it's really the jackpot, it's a dealer I never heard of and an artist I never heard of. And I especially like to buy before an artist even, you know, has gallery representation, because I'm lucky enough to be invited to do crits to different schools.
Mm-hmm.
And I often go to visit MFA students.
Mm-hmm.
At Rutgers, Pratt, Cranbrook, which is just 20 minutes away from where I am right now.
Mm-hmm.
I have a nice relationship with University of Nevada, Las Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
And I probably go there twice a year and do studio visits. They have a 3-year MFA program, so it's really fun to go to the studio you know, for 3 years.
Right. That's great. Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because one of the things that I did want to ask you, which you've already answered, is if you find work other than, you know, what you see in the art fairs and the galleries, and obviously you're getting in on the ground floor with the MFA studio visits. So what is that like? You want to give me sort of a snapshot of that?
Well, it's a completely fantastic, wonderful mm-hmm. experience. Mm-hmm. I mean, tying in with that, there's two things I could say about that. Is I love when an art dealer or a museum person comes to see my collection and there's not the usual suspects, and they discover an artist in my collection and months later put the artist in a group show or have a solo show. Since it's not my business art, it's not how I make my living, I love to help people.
Mm-hmm.
One of the most wonderful things that's been happening over the years is I used to be MFA programs have a class called Professional Practices.
Right.
Are you familiar with such a class?
Yes.
So, in case anyone listening isn't familiar with it, it's you go to art school, you get your MFA, and then you got to go out in the big world and try to make a living. So, these classes bring in, let's say, an arts lawyer, a curator, a museum person, a gallerist, and I've become, from word of mouth, known that me, the collector, who doesn't like to be called collector,
right.
I used to go do slideshows and guest lectures. And now it's field trips to my home for the MFA class.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this month, I think it was the most. I had University of Massachusetts Amherst, Rutgers twice, Penn State, and it's really fun. We have the classroom in my home, and I give a little tour of my collection and then talk about different issues and give advice.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always so much fun. Each one is different,
right?
Because it's really lots of participation between the students.
Mm. So you have these classes into your house. They get to go around and look at your collection and do you give some kind of presentation? How does that part work?
Yeah, it's more of a guided tour, but I'm mm-hmm. not, if we go off on a tangent, that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
And I always have them wear name tags
mm-hmm.
so I could call on them and say, you know, what do you think this piece is about? What do you think it's made of? How do you think it's made? Because they're all studio artists.
Right.
Yeah, it's an informal art tour with an introduction and lots of interruptions and interjections, and everyone's very proper and poised when they first get in, as they're a little not comfortable, but by the time the class is over, we're all laughing and having fun and I'm knowing their names. And by now I run into them, you know, all over the place, all these students over all these years.
You know, it's funny. What you just described is just what I would like to happen in the podcast. So think of the podcast as like an audio version of doing a tour, only you're not in the same room with those people.
The only thing weird about it is that there's no visuals.
Yes.
Well, you said
you have to use your imagination. You got to use your imagination. You did mention before that that you've had curators, was it, that you said over to see your collection as well? Are these museum curators or?
Yeah, well, not being modest, but like now I've become like famous. Like I'm very known,
mm-hmm.
you know, as a person who likes to open their collection to people.
And, right.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, people from the Whitney have come over, from the Newark Museum.
Mm-hmm. And are they
St. Louis? I can't even remember all the people who have come over.
And so they're in generally getting a particular angle on the art world through your eye, and potentially seeing some artists that they haven't seen.
Well, I mean that's for sure, because I don't want to say something that it's wrong, but I usually buy emerging artists. Like a big example is Cindy Sherman. I bought Cindy Sherman, you know, before most people ever heard of her. And I know I told you I don't like to talk about money, but I don't mind talking about money when it's a little bit of money.
Okay. Okay.
So I'll break my own rule.
Okay.
is that, you know, I'm proud to say my first Cindy Sherman film still, well, it was $1,000 minus a 20% discount, was $800.
Wow.
But what there is in my collection, which you, I know, looked at my site. I don't know if you saw the installation shots on
my
site.
I did, yeah.
You know, there's Richard Prince, you know, next to an artist whose first year MFA at Pratt.
Mm.
Just last weekend, well, the students came over from Pratt, and they said, why don't you come over to Open Studios? So I went to Open Studios, and it was so much fun that the different students, I don't remember them all, but many of them had been in my apartment. I think I sent you one of the pieces. I bought a piece from him last weekend, and I didn't think there was any space left in my apartment, and we found a place and hung it. It's really fun. He hadn't been to my apartment yet, but he's going to be coming next semester.
Well, since you mentioned buying from the MFAs, you know, even first year MFAs, can you talk about what that interaction is like? I mean, do they have a set? Maybe they're hoping that you're going to buy something, but let's just say, do they have a set price in mind, and do you have a negotiation, or how does that work?
Well, this is really funny. What I really like, since I am a known person, I love when someone doesn't know what I am, that I have a collection. I love when it's like fresh like that. Wait, what was your question?
So my question is, generally with your studio visits of MFA students in their studio, when you end up buying a piece, do they have a set price, you know, and then and you either take it or you negotiate, or how does that work?
I'll tell you something. I'll break off to say that once I had a big birthday party and everyone in the party, you know, gave a speech about me, like a roast or something.
Mm-hmm.
But this one artist, Trisha Kately, and I really hadn't noticed this. She says that I am the one who often buys the first work from an artist. Like, she's talked, because when I first bought some from her, I was the first person I ever bought, as opposed to your mother, father, or aunt,
right,
uncle, or cousin,
right,
like a real person. And it's really funny. I would say this guy might have sold a couple before, but I was one of his first people to buy it. Do I have a negotiation? You know, I never do that sort of stuff. I'm uncomfortable doing that. For example, when people go to flea market, they're supposed to say a price and you're supposed to say a lower price. Like, I'm not comfortable. I guess I'm not comfortable talking about money, which you've realized. I usually, you know, whatever their price is, which they have no idea how to figure out a price, if I can afford it, it makes sense to me, I say, okay, I don't haggle. But really, when I'm invited to do a crit, I don't really think it's proper or right that I go around being an art collector when I do this.
Right.
I usually, because it seems a little tacky, or something doesn't seem right about it.
But when does the piece get purchased by you then, ideally?
So if I'm invited, like, to University of Nevada, Las Vegas, or Rutgers, or Cranbrook, which I did Cranbrook last month, I might take some pictures, or, you know, they give me their card or their phone number, and I might call up and say, hey, you know, I really like this piece, you know, would you want to sell it to me?
Mm.
It's more like subtle, like,
right,
that.
Right, sure, got it. Well, you said a minute ago that many of the artists, or you made it sound like all of the artists virtually in those studio visit situations have no idea how much the work should sell for. But yeah, again, if many of them are taking these professional practice classes, they probably should, shouldn't they?
Yeah, but then, or sometimes it's like, you know, they might, because sometimes it might be too low, or, I mean, it's like, who knows how much something should be worth,
right,
or sold for. It's funny, in regard to this, I'm not making a different tangent, is that one of my advice to the students, which has to do with your question, is you only have one chance to have your first one-person show, and unless you're going straight to Barbara Gladstone or Metro Pictures, which you usually don't, you should make it so the whole shell sells out. You know, it's your first chance to have them priced right, so it's democratic. So
price them to sell is what you're saying.
Sometimes people say some ridiculous amount based on the amount of time it took to make the work, which
right.
I always think is funny, because if we did that with Jackson Pollock, he can make a work in 2 minutes. So it doesn't it's not by how much time you spent on me. You
sure.
know, it seems like a lot of artists do that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But I don't ever want to insult an artist or make them feel bad. I'll just say no, thank you. If someone's first year MFA and they say the painting's $7,000, you know, I'll just say no, thank you.
Yeah, got it.
Because I don't want to get into that. It's like a touchy subject.
Sure, sure. So we're on the eve of, or, you know, a few days on the eve of the Miami Art Fair season or week, which you're going to. How have you been going, say, every year for the last decade or so?
It's always feeling it's funny when people call, they say, are you going to Basel? But they really mean, are you going to Basel, Miami? But I'm proud to say I've been going to Basel, Switzerland every year since 1990.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, that's the mother of all art fairs. So that's 10. I've been going to that one for 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I've gone to every Basel, Miami. One thing that happened to me, very exciting, which is on my website. I don't know if you had a chance to read that page, the press page, is the first year they had the Miami Basel Art Fair. The Miami Herald did a spread on me, and it was called How to Navigate an Art Fair. And a reporter and photographers followed me around for 3 days, and they did like this 4-page article that was in the Miami Herald. I think that was 2002.
What was that like, being followed around?
It was really fun. I like attention. you know, I felt like it was really fun. And then, you know, I know so many people, so what this reporter did, her name was Elisa Turner, when she'd run into someone like another collector or another art dealer or another artist, she'd also interview them. So there was quotes in it. I mean, what I said about this, I'm glad my parents were alive to read this. My parents are still alive. Is it was almost like an obituary while I was alive, you know?
Mm. Well, what is it like? How do you navigate the art fair? I mean, the first Miami Basel you went to was probably relatively mellow compared to the one that's been going on the last 5 years, right?
Well, I'm trying to think. What I was going to say is, I mean, last year I think they said there were 25 fairs. There's all these satellite fairs.
Sure.
I can't even remember if the first one, there might have just been, oh boy, I don't even know if Nada existed or Pulse existed, but I do. Of course, I'm not going to go to all 25, and some of them are really awful.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to mention which ones are awful, but of course, there's the big one, which by now, I usually can't afford to buy something from that one, but I used to.
Mm-hmm.
I used to buy stuff from the big one,
mm-hmm.
but now it's, I don't know, over my budget.
So what
I
are
still buy a few things.
What are your primary satellite fairs then?
So I'd say Nada's my favorite. I also like Untitled, which I think has been going on for 4 or 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
I go to Pulse.
Mm-hmm.
I am into Prince. I'm not a Prince snob. And there used to be one called Ink. I'm not sure if they still have it.
Right.
There's something I tell fellow collectors, like some people have all these rules. Especially if it's a collecting couple.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
what kind of rules do they have?
A couple would only buy German works on paper by German artists from the 30s. I mean, that's so
right.
limiting.
Right.
But there are people I know who won't buy prints. And what I say about this to those print snobs is I don't care if it's edition of 20 or 200. When it's in my home, there's only one.
Right.
I basically buy prints, for example, John Curran. I went to his first show at Andrea Rosen Gallery, and I didn't really, like, get it. Now I do, and I like his work, so, and this is, I guess, how a collector would think. So I'm on this mission. I'll buy every print that John Curran has made. Or Carol Dunham. Sometimes I miss the boat. Carol Dunham, I can't afford to buy Carol Dunham anymore, so I have two prints by him.
Right. But let's get back, Steve, let's get back to Miami generally. What is, okay. I think more than just, you know, which fairs do you like? What, how do you navigate it? I mean, is basically, do you need to be on, you know, like 24/7? Do you need to start from when the fair is open in the morning and then go to all the parties at night and just do that, you know, the whole time you're there? Or how does that
work?
You
want to know something, you know, I could say, I don't really want to stay up all night. I don't drink alcohol. I don't drink coffee. Like, my buzz I get from finding, looking at art.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't go to parties. I go to dinners with friends. That's what I like.
Mm-hmm.
But how do I navigate? I start out by going whatever order the first one is that opens.
Mm-hmm.
Like Untitled used to open on Monday. I don't think any are opening on Monday. Navigating which fair to go to. So I go to the one in order of when they have the previews.
Sure.
So I know it's Untitled. I'm going Tuesday at 1 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
Then I'll go to the big one, Big Basel, Miami, 11 a.m. Wednesday, and then I'll go to NADA the next day.
So basically,
is it
like a fair a day? In other words, you'll do the main one in one day, or will you go back?
You know, I'm pretty OCD, and
right.
I don't like to, of the fairs I go to, I don't like to miss anything, so I actually carry the map in my hand,
mm-hmm.
and put in... I check off every gallery I go to and what I might have liked at that gallery. I take pictures,
mm-hmm.
and I put an arrow which way I was walking down the aisle.
Wow!
Because it's so funny. I know you're an artist, and a lot of artists don't like going to art fairs. Have you gone to many art fairs yourself?
I have not gone to many. I've gone to about three.
Oh my God! I wonder if I've gone to 1,000.
Wow.
But anyway, you start talking to someone, and there's all sorts of – sometimes there's three ways to get into a gallery from a booth.
Right.
From aisle C or from aisle B or from this end or that end.
Mm-hmm.
And so I put an arrow on the aisle on the map of
mm-hmm.
which way I was going.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, talk about, like, the collectors that I'm not –
right.
The trophy ones.
Right.
What I hear and what I read about is they fly in on a private jet and go into the fair and go to the 10 booths that they already have a relationship with.
Right.
And do the fair in 3 hours. I mean, Basel, Switzerland, it takes me 3 full days.
Sure. Sure.
And Basel, Switzerland has other satellite fairs that other cities don't have. My favorite being List Affair, L-I-S-T-E.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like it's in some old high school. I don't know what the place is, but that's one of my favorite fairs in Basel, Switzerland, as far as satellite fairs.
Right, right. When you're,
and they got fantastic museums to go to in Basel, too.
Sure, sure. When you're, get back to Miami, though, since this is our case example, since this is going to probably be going up maybe as that is finishing or going on, when you're going around to the booths, particularly, say, at the main Basel fair at Miami, how would you say you're treated, or how do you feel, or is that something you even notice?
Well, I mean, I'm treated very well because, you know, I'm a, you know, respected person in the art community, and I've known by now, I've been doing it so long,
mm-hmm.
is that all the people that I see in the art, at the different art galleries, I could tell you the last four galleries they worked at or what museum they worked at. It's a whole family to me. What also I've been noticing is gallerists who had a mid-size gallery or maybe a little below mid-size who went out of business, or closed.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of those people who I bought work from now work, you know, at big galleries.
Right.
I see that a lot. It's like, it's sad, but they seem to be happy.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of examples of that.
So you basically know, say, at Basel, Miami, you know all of the gallerists in every booth. Is that what you're saying?
Well, that would be hard to say. I don't know if I know that, but I know I can't really take one step without running into someone. And that brings up that is one of my great pleasures of being part of the art world. It becomes like a family. I mean, I just like talking to people, and I mean, that brings up the point, like after I get something by an artist, I like to invite them over to one of my salons. I also do salons, which isn't classes. It's a la Gertrude Stein is how I like to say it.
Mm-hmm.
And I invite maybe 10 people over and serve some food buffet style. And I give my tour and we talk. And I like for the artist to see their work in the context of my collection, which is me as artist/curator.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's interesting the different themes that have popped up subconsciously. So it is my collection is a curated show. You know, about my personality.
So Steve, these all of these 10 people at your salons, roughly 10 people, are all people who are in your collection and they're going to see their work?
No. They could be just friends, or I don't have a piece by them. No, it could be anything, but all they have to do is to like art or want to know about art. Like at these salons, I don't want to talk about I don't want to be about talking about a baseball game. It's to talk about art.
Right. So how do you choose the people?
Then? Some of these salons, some people have met each other and they've become friends.
So you're further fostering community in the larger art community is what you're doing, what you're saying.
I think so. You know, as opposed to, again, the some other type of collectors who just open their home and it's just, you know, hundreds of people piling through. They get a private tour from the curator of the show.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Actually, I just made that up, but that's like, it's actually true. It's like I'm the docent it's like a docent tour in a museum.
Well, one of the things that we can say about you from what I gather from your site and, you know, and from the little that we've talked is that you are a hands-on collector as opposed to the many collectors out there
who have advisors.
Have advisors, exactly, and staff and so on and so forth.
Well, can I tell you something? I'm not going to mention his name.
Sure.
There's a very, very... He's a nice guy. I know him. I'm friends with him. I've been to some of his homes.
Mm.
And he's a huge collector.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been invited to, you know, parties there, cocktail parties. And the first time I went there, he said, like, who's this by? He didn't know. And I said, who's this by? He didn't
right.
know. Anyway, I stopped asking him because he has several advisors or curators who buy the work for him.
Right.
But it's funny, and I might have asked him a couple questions, but then I can end up giving the tour in many people's homes.
Yeah,
which I think is funny.
That's kind of one version of the trophy collector, you know, somebody who just gets somebody to buy work for them and then doesn't really have that much connection with them, the work.
Except, you know, again, I'm not going to mention the name, but, oh, my God, what this guy does philanthropically. He's also involved in a theater. He just, you know, he just doesn't put the time into it that I do, that I do. I don't want to hold it against him too much because he's like a great person.
Mm. So, Steve, when
we could talk about Eli Broad. You know, I'm sure he knows his artists, but he only buys famous artists.
Sure. And, yeah, a lot of big collectors only do that.
But God bless him. But you know, that's a huge trophy. You open up your own museum. But I'm so thankful to him that I got to go there. I made a special trip to LA to go there. I read it, and I'm interested in him. I read his autobiography recently.
Well, I want to get back to your collection. So you've had many, many different kinds of tours in your place, and then you've presented your collection outside of your place at schools and whatnot. I see a certain sensibility in your collection, a fairly consistent sensibility. I'm wondering if, A, you have a sort of description of it, a way that you describe it, and, B, if you've gotten feedback from the various people that have come to see your collection that you think is either on the mark or way off the mark.
Well, that's at the end of the tour. Well, first of all, I wanted to add something to what you said about out there. I'm more than happy to loan things for shows, either in galleries or museums.
Mm-hmm.
That had
mm-hmm.
to do with how you were just talking.
Okay.
I'm nervous that they'll be damaged, but I do it.
But they insure them, don't they?
You know, it's really funny. Yeah, insurance, but I don't want the money. I want the art.
Right. So you want them to be...
I'll just give you an example about that. What if the artist is dead? But it's funny. Twice someone's wanted to buy... I'm not sure if you're familiar with Sarah Charlesworth.
Of course.
You know her work?
I do.
Do you know she died of a brain hemorrhage like 2 years ago, I think, or 3 years ago?
No, pretty recently. Probably less than 2 years ago.
Well, anyway, I knew her. I was friendly with her. I bought 2 Sarah Charlesworth, which are in the room next to me in my parents' bedroom. They've been hanging there since, I think, the 80s. I was asked to loan 2 of those pieces to SUNY Purchase. No, the Neuberger Museum. And she did something unusual. She didn't glaze her work. She just has some laminate on them, and I've been in that museum, the Neuberger, and there's like one guard walking around for 3 rooms, and it's a bunch of students there, and it's like almost like a naked photo, and it's funny. I said, you know, well, I'll loan it, but you got to ask Sarah if it gets ruined, would she like print another one and sign it?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, well, now she's deceased. But
well, did the work get ruined?
I don't know.
Ruined?
Some works can't be, you know. I don't want the money for it.
But did the work get damaged, or is this just a theoretical situation?
You know, I think by the time I was through asking all the questions, they borrowed someone else.
Okay, got it. Right.
One of my favorite loans was I loaned a Bernard Fries painting to the Museum of Modern Art Paris for a retrospective, and that was exciting. And then I went to the museum and.
Are you talking about the Pompidou Museum?
No, it's called Musée d'Art Moderne de la Ville de Paris.
Okay.
It's not the Pompidou.
Oh, okay. Got it. Well, let's get back to the question that you shifted
so
around. Yeah,
is,
your sensibility.
I remember the question. So I think you're talking about themes, but at the end of these salons, I ask people, well, what was your favorite piece? And people always make a joke, oh, why don't you ask which piece would they like to steal? But I always like to hear different themes. And I never knew I had any themes until 1994, a museum in New Jersey called the New Jersey Center of Visual Arts in Summit, New Jersey, borrowed 15 of my works for a show called New Jersey Collects.
Mm-hmm.
And they asked me to give some 2 lectures while the show was up. And I didn't know how I would start, how I would organize it. And I started looking at my collection, and that's when I found themes.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what you're leading to.
Well,
am I correct?
I think there's a difference between themes and sensibility. Sensibility is a little bit more nuanced. It's a little bit more je ne sais quoi. You know what I mean? It has to do with the mediums. It has to do with the style. It has to do with the I think your work let me give it a stab. You have a strong figurative tendency. You have a strong visceral tendency. You have a little bit of a sort of post East Village sort of sensibility. I mean, these are the kinds of things that I'm talking about. Does that make sense?
But, you know, it's funny. I don't think anyone's exactly asked me that. Well, you know what the sensibility is probably going to be? The adjectives that describe me as a person, probably.
Okay, such as?
Because, well, there's real bold stuff. There's not a lot
That's
of straight
true.
Lines. There's
a lot
not
of bold.
The color.
Yep.
Is this what you're talking about?
Yep. Exactly. Keep going.
And I guess someone once said, they said two words. One of them is irreverent.
Huh.
Is that what you mean, sensibility?
That could be a word for sensibility, yes.
I like when people take the rules and, like, piss all over it sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But you didn't exactly want to hear themes, but I think some of my themes are about sensibility, like mm-hmm. when you were talking.
Mm-hmm.
My most favorite theme is seduction meets repulsion,
mm-hmm.
but then add sense of humor to it. And then add art about art. I think it's often looking back at our history.
Right.
Like, I have this painting by Annie Lappin. She's an LA artist. I bet you know her.
I know her
work.
She
shows it on her Fraser now. Yep. She used to show it Angles.
Yep, that's correct.
Do you know her?
I don't know her, but I know her work. Yeah.
Her work. Her
yeah,
work.
I do.
That's what I mean.
I do.
So anyway... I mean, this piece, it took me 3 seconds to buy. I bought it at the Armory Show from mm-hmm. Angles Gallery, mm-hmm. which that is an extremely sad closure. I don't know if you're familiar with Angles.
Of course I am. I invited one of the former members, or the gallery director, to come on the show. And
Noel.
He passed, yes.
Noel, right?
Correct. He passed. He said, no, thank you.
Oh, I thought you just said he passed away.
No, he passed
that
on coming on the show.
That guy, I love that guy, plus I love David. I've known those people for years.
Why do you describe it as an especially sad closing?
That they closed. I mean, it's just sad.
Well, they had a long
I
run, didn't they?
There.
They had a long run, right?
Well, it's just sad. It's sad for me. I can't go there anymore. I don't see them anymore. I don't have their personal phone numbers. But,
right.
I enjoy talking to them. I mean, that was one of the – usually I like to rush through galleries. I like to try to do as many as I can. But
mm-hmm.
they would always bring me back there, and we would talk for an hour, like, about everything. It was, like, so much fun talking to them.
I see.
And they respected me very much for who I was, not if I was going to buy something. To get back to – I don't even know where
to
I am.
To Annie Lappin.
To talk about the Annie Lappin that I bought –
mm-hmm.
It's so cool. So Annie Lappin, of course, is a woman, and she has a feminist approach to this, to Manet's painting called Le Déjeuner sur l'Herbe from like the 1880s. I imagine you're familiar with that painting.
Sure.
It's, if anyone listening isn't familiar with it, it's a naked woman like at a picnic on the grass with all these clothed men.
Right.
And so this is an example. I think I'm staying on your question. I like to go off track, but I think I'm staying on your question. My sensibility is the epitome of this painting. And so she alters the painting, and she takes all the men out, and she leaves there with her handmaid was with her. And then I call it George Kondoizes the painting. Like, she takes the men out, and then she messes it all up.
Mm-hmm.
If you want, I like to give you another example. I think this is sensibility. I think I'm answering your question.
Okay.
It's my Deborah Cassis work.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you're familiar with Deb Cass.
I am.
She's now a really good friend of mine.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is brilliant. Simon Watson, he had a gallery,
mm-hmm.
and then he used to show out of his living room. It was called Simon Watson's Living Room.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, he did a show of Deb Cassis in his living room in downtown Manhattan. It was called Jewish Jackie Series.
Right.
So I just think this is brilliant. So Deb is a Jewish lesbian, Warhol a Catholic gay male. She researched all his work, and she found that he never did Barbara Streisand, but he did plenty of Jackie Kennedy. So she researched every way that Warhol did Jackie Kennedy, and she inserted Barbara Streisand.
Mm-hmm.
And I have two works of those. Am I answering your question? That's the irreverence.
A little bit. I'm grateful for the fact that you mention these celebrities, because that's a perfect segue for something that I also wanted to talk about, which is that you have a section of your site devoted to you and these encounters or meetings that you had with Diana Ross, with Tom Cruise, with several other people, Hugh Jackman, and so on. And I'm just wondering, what that's about. Is that because you're aficionados of these people, et cetera?
I'll tell you.
Sure.
Well, first of all, I made these books, like they're not like published books. I made these celebrity books. I'm on my second one now, but I publish them through Blurb.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're also, I have them digitally, which I could send you. I'm basically starstruck, but just not anybody, people who I think are talented. And I like meeting them. And what's happened is, besides me being interested in visual art, I'm interested in Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
And I've started being, it's called in London, it's called being an angel for a Broadway show. It's not exactly co-producer. I mean, what I call it now is losing money.
Right.
But there was this actor that I'm crazy about. His name is Cheyenne Jackson. He now lives in West Hollywood. Are you familiar with Cheyenne Jackson?
Yeah, he's a Broadway actor who has a lot of lead roles on Broadway, right?
Yeah, he did, and he's on TV a lot now.
Mm-hmm.
He's on something with, I don't watch TV, he's on something right now with Lady Gaga.
Not familiar with that, okay.
But anyway, he's an extremely handsome, talented singer, actor, he's a comedian. Anyway, I had a friend who's a Broadway producer, and he was going to be in a show called Finian's Rainbow. And my purpose was, I'll invest in it, because when you invest in a show, you get to go to opening night plus the party after.
Right.
And I got to, Cheyenne knows who I am now. He has my business card on his refrigerator, he told me. And so basically this investing in Broadway is so I can meet the people I respect so much.
Mm-hmm.
I met Patti LuPone, for example.
Yeah.
One of my biggest meets was Jessica Lange. I'm a huge fan of hers.
Mm-hmm.
And I happen to have a friend who has a photography gallery. His name's Howard Greenberg, and he knew I liked Jessica Lange, and he did a show of Jessica Lange's photos, and he told her all about me, and he arranged a walkthrough with me, for me with Jessica Lange going through her show.
Mm.
I don't know, did I answer your question?
Yeah, I mean it sounds like you're enamored with certain types of celebrities with a focus on Broadway.
Broadway and movies, like
Broadway and
Diana
movies.
Ross. Okay, mm-hmm. that's a really personal thing. I grew up since the day I was born with a black nanny who was from South Carolina.
Mm.
And I have a thing. I have two mothers, one black and one white. And I have a thing for black women, singers, actresses. And I'm completely in love with Diana Ross. My parents took me to see the Supremes when I was like 12 years old in Miami Beach.
Mm-hmm.
And Diana Ross definitely knows who I am by now. As I go to all her concerts, I usually sit in front row.
So you met her at one of her concerts or afterwards?
Well, she knows me from the audience, but then there was a it's called Bergen Performing Arts Center,
mm-hmm.
in northern New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
She did a show there, and I was calling up that I wanted front row seats and what kind of donation can I make because it's a not-for-profit.
Mm-hmm.
And they told me the amount, and I said, well, if you give that amount, you get to go to a meet and greet after the concert. So I met her then. But I also met her once in 1979 when I was waiting for my mom to come in from Detroit at the airport.
Mm.
I know her sister. But you want to hear something funny about celebrities? So
yeah.
One of my prized possessions is my Andy Warhol Polaroid of Diana Ross.
Right. I saw that on the site.
You did?
Yeah.
I don't know if you want to know a funny story about how I got that and who
sure.
paid for it.
What's
Would
the story?
Would you like to hear that?
What's the story?
So my parents are getting older, and when I'm in an art fair, I usually don't like to be distracted by answering phone calls, but if it's my mother or father, I'm going to answer it because any phone call I get from Michigan, I think someone's dead.
Right.
It's terrible, but my right. dad's 90 now, my mom's 87. Mm. But anyway, I'm walking at Pulse Art Fair in Miami some years ago, and I'm just walking around, and I get a phone call to my mom. And so I answer. I say, "Hi, Mom, how's everything?" And then that second, I see an Andy Warhol photo of Diana Ross. And I said, oh, my God, this is what I just saw. And my mom said, she'll buy it for me.
Wow.
But she didn't ask me how much it was, but she said she'd buy it for me. So it's a special gift from my mom.
Hmm.
And I don't know, I think 4 weeks later, she says, "By the way, how much was it?" And I told, I think I tripled the price to just get her scared, but I knew it was an affordable price for her.
Got it. Right. Steve, thank you so much for talking to me.
It was my pleasure.
Great. And we're out. Hey again, everybody. I just want to let you know before we get to this second part that I spoke to Steve again when he was down in Miami. He was in his hotel room when we spoke Tuesday night, so he had been able to see Untitled and another satellite fair as well, which we talk a bit about. Still many fairs to come, but got a taste of what Miami is like for a collector, for this collector. And there are a couple of questions that I felt like were unaddressed, as I said, in our first phase. So I said, let's get back on the phone, Steve, and talk some more. And we did. And so here that is. I hope you enjoyed it. And I will talk to you more on the very back end. Thank you for being here.
Hey, Steve, how's Miami?
Well, it's fantastic. How many times have I been coming here? I started in 2002. That's when Basel, Miami started.
Right. So 13, 14 years.
I mean, I'm having a fantastic time socially. From the minute I checked in my hotel, it seems like just so many people I know
mm-hmm.
are at this hotel, collectors and dealers and curators. And that's half the fun is, or maybe that's 75% of it, the social experience I have.
Sure.
Because I've been doing this art thing for 40 years, I calculate it.
Right.
So you can imagine by now I have so many friends.
I know because we sort of talked about this earlier, that this is your first day of actually seeing things because you were there yesterday, but none of the fairs were open. So let me just ask you this first leading question. Did
okay.
you make any purchases today?
Well, okay. So that's going to be a funny answer. That can't just be yes, no.
Sure.
Because... So I went to Untitled first. It's called Untitled Fair. It's, I'm not sure, is it fourth or fifth year? It's on a built tent that they right on the beach at 12th Street and Ocean. So to answer your question is, I ran into my good friend Mark Stangbush, who I met by doing a studio visit at Cranbrook, and he said, "Hey, want to go to this unfair, like anti-fair?"
Mm-hmm.
Like after Untitled.
Mm-hmm.
And I had gotten some emails, so I know some artists who said they were in it. It's funny, I get all these emails from all the artists I know of what fair they're in and what booth, and it's just so funny. And so we went to this. It was really cool. It's one of the best experiences I had in Miami. It's an abandoned motel. Way an upper Miami Beach, like 74th and the Ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And it's these abandoned motels that are going to be all torn down. And these artists and curators took over the motel, and they curated shows, of which, this is getting to your question, of which they can't give a price list. Mm. They didn't print a price list.
Mm-hmm.
You have to contact the artist yourself because these people aren't going to get a cut of the sale.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's so funny. You know, I'd say, how much is this? Well, we don't know. So it really worked. And then, but one of the most, I don't want to say best, the most fascinating room I went into was someone who knew me. I didn't remember them. Her name is Julie Torres, and she's an artist curator. And she called the motel room Art in America. And she had this tumbler to gather artists. She wanted to have one artist from every state, all 50 states plus Puerto Rico. And she got all sorts of responses, and she picked one artist from every state. And, of course, the artist she chose from Las Vegas is an artist I've become friends with from University of Nevada, Las Vegas. And so I found a piece that I liked a lot.
Steve, can I interject for a second?
Sure.
Who's the UNLV artist that you're talking about?
Her name is Audrey Barcio.
Okay. Let's give her a little plug.
I bought like three pieces by her when I went to her studio. Now she's my good buddy by now.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, that was funny that she's in what I think was one of the most interesting rooms. And so I said, okay, I like this piece by Jacqueline Segura. And I'm sorry, I'm forgetting what state she lives in.
That's okay.
And I said, well, I want to buy this. And so she says, well, I'll do you a favor. I'll text her. And by the time then I left, I was at dinner. She'll text me and find out how much it is. And so we just thought this was hilarious, my friends and I, when sitting dinners, that we're going to finally find out the price, and then I could buy it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the artist says it's not for sale, which I think is, what the hell did you send this piece to Miami? And then it's not for sale. So it's funny you ask me a good leading question.
Yeah.
I wanted to buy it, but I can't. So they were successful to being an anti-fair.
Yeah, I was thinking the exact same thing. It sounds like the fair is really delivered as being an anti-fair. Did you try any other works?
Yeah, and then she wasn't allowed to give the list. She said she really wasn't supposed to pass out the list with the artist names and the image and the state. But, well, she said I could have it. But it was really funny, this piece, and she made it really fast. I bet she has like 40 others like it. It's a work on paper, but I don't know why she would make this one not for sale.
Huh. Any other exciting or intriguing takeaways from the day?
Well, yeah, I mean, an Untitled, which every time I go to Untitled, I always fall in love with a certain work and often get it. Like last year, I bought this piece by Ethan Greenbaum. I never heard of him, from his gallery, Kansas. And we've become buddies. And his work was so interesting, the process. But I did discover one new artist at my friend's Braven Lee Project of New York, at Untitled, by an artist I never heard of named Judith Henry. And they're photos, so I don't have to rush to buy it, but I'm going to probably decide and most likely get one.
Mm. Is she a New York artist?
Yes.
Okay.
She lives in Brooklyn.
Uh-huh.
You want me to tell you briefly what she does?
Okay, sure. We'll give it a shot.
Okay. So she goes around, she makes these masks, and she goes around places in Brooklyn and holds the mask and sits in different settings.
Mm.
That's one series.
Mm-hmm.
And then she does other series where she takes like a mask of Elizabeth Taylor or Judy Garland or Katharine Hepburn and actually places them in a setting, like in a bar, in a park, on a bench, and then takes a picture.
Mm-hmm.
It reminded me a lot of the Rimbaugh series by David Wojnarowicz.
Mm.
But I would say, she's my takeaway discovery.
Right.
And I mentioned that I have all these students come to my house for these MFA
right
classes, and And there's always a star student in each time they come over. And there's this artist from Texas, Matt Kleberg, who is a Pratt MFA, and he graduated. And I know I've looked at his website, and I found it really exciting. I've never seen his work in person. So my friend Catherine Mulheron had his work in her booth, and that was exciting for me. It looked like even a lot better than when I look at his website.
Right. I just wanted to check that do you have reproductions that you took of both of those two artists that you just mentioned's work that
oh, definitely.
Yeah, okay, good.
Because what I do now, you know, it's so funny. I'm old enough where it's really funny. I was thinking about this. It used to be when you'd go into an art gallery or a booth at an art fair that you'd go up and say, do you mind if I take this a picture of the work? But now, you know, you just go take all the pictures you want.
Right.
So I don't have to take notes. I take a picture of what work interests me, and then I take a picture of the label of the artist's name. So
right. Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
I have them.
It's the Instagram era, after all.
Right.
Okay. Well, I'm glad to hear things have been going well. It's early still for you at Miami, but there are a couple.
Tomorrow's the opening of the big fair.
Exactly. So, but
I'm going at 11 a.m.
I did want to get to the couple things that I mainly wanted, maybe three things, but a couple of things in any way that I wanted to follow up with you about that I thought about since we finished our original talk.
Do you mind if I tell you something? I thought of something that you would like to hear. Something I want to mention. I'm always mentioning positive things. I just want to mention briefly of something that turns me off when I'm at a booth and almost makes me want to run away.
Sure.
And I don't know if this is advice for people, but when I ask a dealer, I say, so can you tell me who's this by and something about the artist? This is what turns me off. What I want to know is, what is the artist's work about? What's on their mind? What do they want to say? How is the work made? But this is what I would say. They start to say things, well, things that is like buying art with your ears, and that is, well, the person just got a Guggenheim grant. There's going to be an article in Art in America.
Oh, jeez.
The artist is going to be in the Whitney Museum. And here's the worst thing is when, I know you're an artist yourself, and they say, well, and the artist made this especially for the Untitled Art Fair.
Right.
And I'm saying, well, that's terrible. I mean, made the work for an art fair instead of making the work because the artist had it in their heart and soul to make a work that they're making the work for a deadline to be sold at an art fair.
Yeah.
And I used to just, like, say nothing, but now, you know, I don't care. I just want to tell them. I said, you know, I don't know if you realize, but that's a negative. That's not a positive.
Right.
And well, I try to be polite, and I say, you know, you're really turning me off. Please talk about the work. But I know, getting back to our other conversation, I know, and that's what the dealer's telling me. He says, well, a lot of people, they just want to hear that.
And
I said, well, that's sad, but I don't want to hear that. Tell me about the work.
Yeah, well, maybe they'll think twice next time somebody asks them that question, and they won't just give that spiel about, you know, their
resume.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's good to know. Get a little inside snapshot of being at an art fair. The couple of other things, though, that I originally wanted to talk about after our original conversation, maybe three things, but let's start with the first main two. The first one is, and this actually is kind of a segue from what you were just talking about in a general way, which is the things that you like to talk about and you like to share with your collection, you know, and being, as we talked about originally, how, you know, how much you enjoy and you're passionate about the work that you own and you know, its value to you and what it means to you, and sharing that, you know, with the people that come in your salons and the students, the MFA students who come to your house. So my question is, you have a website where it's a private website where you have
the artist in your collection, and it has some press on you and among images of insulation in your home and so on. So my question is, what is it that keeps you from actually making that more public and sharing that with the world?
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. For security and privacy, I mean, it's a crazy world out there. I want to share my collection with, you know, art world people. I don't want my website. I'm not sure if I'm comfortable saying all the reasons why. I tell you the truth. Sorry.
Right, right. Well, I get the security part, but I guess I wonder, what if you were, instead of sharing all of the sort of private and personal elements, you know, that are there, that if you just took a portion of the work itself and put it on, you know, in some kind of photo context, whether it's Instagram or, you know, some larger photo sharing type environment.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think I've had enough press and enough articles, and I post acquisitions on Facebook. That still is somewhat private, so I don't right. allow everyone to look, only if they're my friends.
Sure. Okay.
I'm not sure what. I'm sorry. What are you exactly getting at? Please?
Well, I was trying to explain with my preface to the question, which is that you are one of the things that you seem to me most passionate about is sharing your passion for art, particularly about your, you know, the work that you have own and have bought over time, and
right.
to limit that to just sort of the people that come into contact with you seems a little counterintuitive. That's basically what I'm getting at.
The reason I don't want my website to be public is for the same reason that I don't like to have open houses. Like, I think I was mentioning that last time during the Armory or Free Show for the VIP program.
Sure.
Certain collectors open their house to anyone who signs up for it. Well, be it within the VIP program of the art fair, I really like to protect my collection, or I like to talk about it. I guess I don't want someone coming in and say, well, this is bullshit. This is a bullshit work. I like to tell the backstory, to explain it, and for the people to understand how it fits into my curatorship.
Right. Is that an experience that you've had going to other people's collections, hearing that kind of comment?
Well, I know, for example, like people maybe that I work with, if I show them something I got or something, you know, I hate that. It's an aggravating question, which I have received even from maybe from a guest of someone I invite to, you know, this question. I mean, I can handle the answer, like, why is this art?
Right.
Some relatives at Thanksgiving started telling me about a work of art they saw and why is it art?
Right.
And I could make it, you know, sort of ignorant people making fun of art. Like, I don't like when that happens. I have answers for them, but really I think they're just disrespecting me or saying they'd rather watch a football game than
sure.
look at some art like that. It's basically they don't understand it. They rather look at a pretty picture of a red barn with some grass than some of the work I have.
Sure. Okay, well, let me get to the other one of the other main questions that I was thinking about, which is something that I pretty much glossed over completely in our original conversation, which was that one of the first things I asked about is what you do on your commute down to New Jersey, which is that you're a physician, you're an anesthesiologist. And you had mentioned towards the beginning of the conversation last time as well that you studied art history and you started collecting. You bought your first piece while you were still in college. I just wonder, what was it in the arc of your career slash life that kept you from actually pursuing an art career of some kind, whether as a historian, curator, what have you, and instead deciding to go into medicine?
Well, I hope my parents never listen to this, but it's very personal, and I could tell you the answer.
Great.
So, I mean, any parent can understand that. I'm not sure if you yourself as a parent. But you want your children to be financially secure. You don't want them starving. And my parents, because of the culture I come from, you know, wanted me to be, you know, a professional person, like a physician. And I went to University of Michigan taking art history, Spanish literature, psychology, and I was a different person there. I'd say I'm not a materialistic person like I was like in high school from the surroundings I was raised in. And my parents basically scared me. I mean, they meant well. You know, they said, well, what the hell are you going to do with this art history? And you want to know something? I think I was too young to even know. I think I said I was going to be a curator, but I don't even think I knew exactly what a curator was. You know, you're so young when you have to make that decision.
Mm-hmm.
So to tell you the truth, my parents scared me. They would say, see the clothes you wear, or see, you know, the vacations you go on, or the car, you know, you're not going to. They basically scared me.
Right.
And I did change to pre-med. I don't think it was like as simple and straightforward as that. And this is very personal stuff I'm telling you, but I don't mind.
Good.
And so I went to medical school in Des Moines, Iowa, which that was one of like the worst times of my life. And every weekend, because I'm such a cultural person, every weekend I would seek art in nearby cities like Chicago, Kansas City. I can't remember some other cities I went to. I went to Omaha. I would try to get as much culture as I could on the weekends. And I went all the way through medical school, and then I started doing a radiology residency in Brooklyn. And I met someone. I was miserable, and I said, I really want to be an art dealer. And this person was, his name was Don, he's from Montreal, and he said, you know, quit complaining about it, you know, like do something about it. So I quit. I quit medicine. I moved with him to Montreal, learned French. I already know Spanish. One of my goals in life was to speak French, and I did that there. And then I came back and worked at one of the most exciting art galleries. This was 1981. I worked at a Nina Nosai gallery.
Wow.
And I'm sure you know that's where Jean-Michel Basquiat.
So you met him, I assume.
Well, we met him. He was painting in the basement of the gallery at 101 Prince Street in Soho.
What was your impression of him?
I didn't like him. He was always like stoned or on drugs, and I didn't want one of the paintings.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's funny. Again, I said I don't want to talk about money, but we were selling his paintings for $5,000 then.
Right.
Maybe a big one was $8,500.
Right.
And it's funny, I bring up my mother again. So not that I sell anything, but, you know, this painting sell for $35 million.
Sure.
And when I was watching all the prices go up, I called my mother again. And I said, you know, I was just a young kid. And I said, Mom, why didn't you ever buy me a Basquiat? You know, I'm really mad at you. I wouldn't have to be working now.
Uh-huh.
You know, I could open up my own museum. And my mom thought for a while. My mom's smart. And she said, did you ever ask me to buy you one? And the answer was no, because I thought he was such a asshole.
Right. That's hilarious.
Let's see. Oh, my God. Now, What was your question? What was I talking
no,
about?
No, I you were addressing it well. It was about you. I think in the arc of the story now, you went to med school, you started a residency, and then you wound up at a Nina Nosay gallery. So when did you get back into medicine, I think, is where we are now.
Okay, yeah, thank you. Thanks for redirecting me.
Sure.
So, I mean, I wasn't making much. I was like believe me, I was not the director of a Nina and Osai gallery.
Right.
I was like the schlepper around guy, you know?
Sure.
I lugged the Basquiat paintings from upstairs. And then I ran into a friend of mine who was an anesthesiologist. So while I was at a Nina and Osai, I submitted an application and had an interview for the Whitney Independent Study Program,
sure,
curatorship,
right,
part. I'm sure, you've heard of that. It's very
absolutely
respectable and reputable. And I put my application in, and I did great at the interview. I remember I really did a great job at all the questions they asked me. But then I was on a boat to Fire Island. I ran into an anesthesiologist, and I was like poor and no money. And he said, well, why don't you come stay with me in South Jersey, come for 3 days, and you could, you know, watch me give anesthesia for 3 days. And so I applied for a residency at that hospital, and I think, I don't know, days after I accepted the residency, I got into the Whitney program, and I already committed myself to the anesthesia residency.
Wow.
So that's the story. But when I first started working as an anesthesiologist, to make money, I became an art advisor to the surgeons.
Wow.
And I was very successful at selling things.
Mm-hmm.
But what was funny was when they wouldn't buy something, then I would. So I spent more than I made.
Mm.
But that was fun. So, you know, me, you know, whatever. It's funny, you call me a collector, but I've also worked in an art gallery.
Right.
I was an art advisor and a collector and a teacher. So I'm like, maybe, you know, you asking me this question, maybe that's why I don't like to be called an art collector, because
sure,
I think I'm so much more.
See, aren't you glad that we came back so that I could ask you about this, so we could get that backstory going?
I was always glad when you asked me. I thought that was flattering. I don't know how many other people you asked to do part two. I don't know.
Well, here's a really important sort of thing that I think you're maybe thinking about but haven't talked about, and that is you have been obviously doing the work of an anesthesiologist for many years now. Do you enjoy it? What is it like for you?
I mean, you know, it's no secret. I mean, I'm a very good doctor. The patients like me. Everyone likes me at work. They think I'm so funny. I make the best of it. But, you know, I'm working with a lot of people, you know, God bless them all. I have such good friends at work who, if I might say the Met, they don't know what that is. A lot of people that I work with,
mm-hmm,
and I try to educate them. I try to be the ambassador, but they've never been in an art museum. Or they maybe once went to MoMA, but they don't know that you need to go every 3 months, that the shows change. They think if you go back to MoMA, it will be the same as it was 10 years ago.
Right.
I mean, recently I was in a panel discussion about contemporary art called Secrets of the Art World. It was at Monmouth University in West Long Branch, New Jersey. And I told a lot of people at work about it. Granted, I didn't know it was a 40-minute ride, but, you know, I mean, one colleague said to me, oh, that sounds like that's the equivalent of taking an Ambien, meaning he'd fall asleep in it.
Uh-huh.
Or one nurse that I like a lot rolls her eyes. I said, what are you rolling your eyes for? She says, well, it'll just be way above my head, which it wasn't, but... I mean, this has to do with one of my favorite themes of my collection being seduction meets repulsion, which I really have that my physician compared to my art life, New Jersey compared to New York, you know, I just get this, I just love, as many times as I've gone through the Holland Tunnel, I just love getting out of New Jersey and into Manhattan.
Yeah, yeah.
Because there's more people like me there.
Sure. Got it. Okay, well, I think I just have one last question for you, Steve, in which
okay,
you may or may not want to answer, but it's This actually came up in a conversation we had in between our original recording and this one. You had just seen the movie Brooklyn, and at one point, I'm not going to get the details right, so you can help me with this. But at one point, you said,
"I know what you're going to say."
Okay, seeing a romance like this makes me actually want to have a boyfriend. Isn't that essentially what you said?
Right. I don't mind time as this thing is getting the second part is getting very personal, which is fine.
Good. Thank you for being open.
It's really hard for me. Well, I have my agenda, which is to just see art and see art and see art. I don't really want to go canoeing or playing golf or watch a baseball game. And it's probably like too much for a lot of people. Like a lot of people can't see art all day and all night like I enjoy doing.
Mm-hmm.
And when I have had a relationship, the person has asked me, you know, well, you have to choose. No, they don't ask me to choose. No, but they say, you know, it's the art is the competition and the art wins.
Mm.
Well, what I was telling you about this movie, which I'm going around telling everyone about this movie because I love doing that. I posted it on Facebook. I think you just mentioned the name. It's called Brooklyn.
Yep.
It was the most romantic movie I ever saw. And, well, I mean, I'm sure there's others. Gone with the Wind is romantic, but it made me, you know, like maybe yearn to have that, but... But, I have a feeling it would just turn into disaster anyway.
But you've been down that road, and you've recognized that the lifestyle that you lead does not allow for having a life partner, basically.
Right. Basically, I don't want anyone to goddamn rain on my parade. Because, like, I like my life, my artful life, my cultural life,
right,
the way it is.
Right, got it.
I mean, okay. One day recently, I think it was a Saturday, I went to a matinee Broadway show, then an evening Broadway show, and then a movie. In between, an artist came over to hang a work, an artist that bought something from Pratt.
Mm-hmm.
I went to some galleries. I mean, I just...
Yeah, you've got.
I don't know.
Where do you
just like it in, to drag someone around,
Steve? Where do you get all this energy? That's what I want to know.
Well, what's really funny is we're getting very personal. Is I have severe sleep apnea, and I don't drink coffee.
Mm-hmm.
I fall asleep if I'm bored in a boring museum or in a boring museum. Or I mean, a boring movie.
Mm-hmm.
I meant to say or. At a red light, I have to put my car in park when I'm in a red light because I can fall asleep.
Wow.
But as long as I'm engaged,
right?
I'm awake.
Right.
I mean, life is short. I want to do what I want to do.
Yeah. Gotcha. Well, Steve, this has been great to get the more personal side of you and get a lot of backstory as well. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, it was nice. Thank you for inviting me.
Absolutely. And we're out number two.
And there you have it. I think we've covered the waterfront now, haven't we? Now we really know Steve, right? I think we got a pretty in-depth portrait of Steve Shane and of the collector who goes to Miami, Steve Shane. So I hope you enjoyed that. Thank you very much to Steve for his generosity. He has already been very helpful in connecting me with some of his collector network, which I really appreciate, and you may be hearing some of them down the road. Your support is very much appreciated for this show. My other fantasy, in case you're curious, that I mentioned on the top end, is that a lot of people who are down in Miami will donate to this show to help keep it going. This is a listener-supported show. Your donations help keep the show going. There are costs involved, particularly the hosting for this, for the site and for the show. So you can donate to the show by going to theconversationpod.com and using PayPal. If you prefer not to use PayPal and pay by check, you can certainly get in touch with me via the website and or theconversationartpodcast@gmail.com, and I can give you an address if you prefer. And one other thing, I was having a conversation with a recent guest about anonymous donating. He was frustrating that various nonprofits/charities that he had given to, he felt like he couldn't donate anonymously. It's like, you're supposedly giving anonymously, but they find out who you are, and he didn't want to do that. So if you want to donate without being hassled, all you have to do is donate, write, this is an anonymous donation, you will never hear from me again, I promise. If you do, I would be happy to give you a shout out on future shows. Of course, you can also support the show by becoming a subscriber on iTunes and writing a nice review. That helps other people find the show. Growth is extremely important in this phase of the podcast. And you can follow the show on social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. All right. Thank you very much. I hope that was a rewarding episode for you, that you enjoyed it. And I appreciate you being here. And I will talk to you soon.